Hello, welcome to Radio Reading Services, weekly edition of the Northwest Press and the Western Hills Press. I'm Joe Bickers, and we'll start off this week with the Northwest Press. Our first story, SWAT spends 2 hours at a Green Township home. Suspect they wanted gets arrested 3 miles away. The man that sent Green Township residents indoors and prompted a soft lockdown at 3 schools Thursday was found 3 miles away from where a SWAT team responded to his home. Christopher Mushrush, age 39, was located walking at the intersection of Van Blarcombe Road and Hillside Avenue, police said. He was taken into custody and charged with attempted arson. Police say he could face other charges as well. At Mushrush's home on Melissa View Court, a SWAT team spent approximately 2 hours urging Mushrush, long gone by then, to come out of his home after his father called police. Mushrush had threatened to burn himself and the house, police said. The incident began as a domestic dispute between Mushrush and his father, said Green Township Police Chief Jim Vetter. Mushrush poured gasoline onto the basement floor and grabbed a lighter, threatening suicide. His father managed to grab the gasoline and lighter from Mushrush before fleeing the residence and calling police. Weapons were in the home, Vetter said. 3 schools are located in the area. It was probably the worst place this could occur, Vetter said. At 2 p.m., the Hamilton County Emergency Management Agency issued an alert to Green Township residents in the area of Melissa View Court and Greenmont Drive to go indoors due to police activity in the area. By 4:30 p.m., authorities gave the all clear. Residents were asked to immediately go indoors and stay inside until further notice. Around 2:50 p.m., SWAT officers used a flashbang at the residence on the corner of Greenmount Drive and Melissa View Court. Police were also using a bullhorn to shout into the home and were broadcasting loud siren noises at the house. Court records show Mushrush was arrested on several drug-related charges in September and October. Documents show Mushrush was arrested October 3rd and had 2 syringes. He was released October 7th, but according to records filed Thursday, he doused his parents' residence and himself with gasoline and threatened suicide. According to neighbors, several residences adjacent to the home were evacuated during the SWAT response. Christopher Mushrush pleaded guilty to possessing drug abuse instruments after he overdosed on heroin in May, court documents state. The overdose occurred in a restaurant. Mushrush gave the responding officer the syringe at the scene, documents state. Mushrush was sentenced to 180 days in prison for the offense. According to court records, all but 3 of those days were suspended. On October 3rd, Mushrush was arrested again after police said he possessed 2 syringes. He was released on October 7th, according to court records. The documents filed Thursday include allegations of aggravated arson. Mushrush's run-ins with the law go back long before the last couple of months. Excuse me. In 1998, Mushrush was sentenced to 10.5 years in prison for inducing panic and felonious assault, the record states. In 2000, he was released to community control on conditions of drug monitoring and maintaining full-time employment. In February 2003, a warrant was issued for Mushrush's arrest after he violated the terms of his probation by testing positive for opiates, according to court documents. Court records state that Mushrush was convicted of 4 drug-related crimes between the years of 2004 and 2015. In 2016, Mushrush pleaded guilty to charges of receiving stolen property and forgery after selling a stolen 2005 Dodge Caravan to a tow company and attempting to cash fraudulent checks. He was sentenced to 33 months in prison. Continuing to read from the Northwest Press, our next story. Man convicted of killing a 3-year-old up for parole. Victim's family fighting to keep him in prison. A man who authorities say kidnapped and killed a 3-year-old boy could walk out of prison next year, although the victim's family is fighting hard to make sure that doesn't happen. On June 18, 1982, 3-year-old Jason Evers disappeared in Springfield Township. For hours, his loved ones searched for any sign of him. It's really been hard for me. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about what happened, Robert Bob Evers, Jason's father, said. It was devastating. I couldn't believe it. Eventually, their efforts came to a soul-shattering conclusion. Jason's body was found in a shallow grave near the playground at the Powell Crosley YMCA, relatives said. Just unbelievable, Ron Evers, Jason's uncle, said. We searched for 6 weeks looking for his body. Adrian Williams, then age 17, became the prime suspect. Williams tried to get ransom for Jason, Bob Evers said, but was caught by the FBI. Investigators revealed that Williams had lured Jason into the woods, kidnapped him, killed him, and then buried his remains. He was ultimately convicted of kidnapping and involuntary manslaughter. Now, 37 years into his 50-year sentence, Williams has another shot at freedom, a parole hearing in 2020. Jason's loved ones have started a petition that's circulating online and on paper. It demands that Williams stay in prison and urges the parole board to not grant Williams parole. To Jason's family, Williams is not only a cold-hearted child killer, but a dangerous man. He killed my son, a defenseless 3-year-old baby, Bob Evers said. We are Jason's voice right now. Jason can't speak for himself, so this petition will help keep Williams in jail. This is not the first time Williams has been up for parole, and he remains in prison. If he remains in prison, he will likely face a parole board again. Although they say it may feel like a never-ending battle, Jason's family members are willing to fight forever. We always wonder, what would Jason look like? Would he be playing ball with us? Would he be karaoke-ing with us? It's still sad, Ron Evers said. He would have been 40 this year, and he's been gone all those years. Now this guy wants to get out. He's got to serve his 50 years. Adrian Williams' parole hearing is set for February 2020. Our next story from the Northwest Press. West Side youth soccer coach arrested on child porn charges. A local youth soccer coach was arrested October 16th after police found multiple child pornography files in his possession, according to court records. Brian Hronick, age 48, of Montford Heights East, is charged with 10 counts of pandering child porn. Police say they found more than 220 images and videos of child pornography on his laptop during a search of his home. Hronick was the head coach of a Cincinnati West Soccer Club team, according to the Greater Cincinnati Soccer League website. He has since been relieved of his duties, club officials told the Enquirer. During a search of Hronick's residence, computer, and cell phone, investigators found images and videos that included children as young as 7 months old being raped by adult men, according to court documents. One of those videos is approximately 48 minutes in length. Police also said there were more than 100 web searches containing known child pornography terms on his cell phone. Some images showed naked children tied to trees or to beds, the documents state. One image showed a naked 1-year-old girl with curse words written on her picture, documents said. Rick Blessing, Cincinnati West president, said the soccer club learned of the investigation by the sheriff's office on October 10th. Law enforcement indicated that none of our players were involved in the investigation, Blessing said. Our director of coaching immediately relieved the coach of his duties with the club. Blessing said Hronick passed all mandatory background checks required by our organization, as well as Ohio Youth Soccer. And our last story today from the Northwest Press. Judge keeps $5 million bond for priest accused of rape. A Hamilton County judge on Wednesday, October 9th, said bond for a priest accused of raping an altar boy 30 years ago will stay at $5 million. Hamilton County Common Police Judge Leslie Giz said her primary concern is that the Reverend Jeff Drew is a flight risk. Your client is charged with anally and orally raping a child, Giz told Drew's attorney, Brandon Mormond. She added, I'm more concerned about him fleeing than anything else. Drew was not in the courtroom for the hearing. He's being held at the Hamilton County Jail. In August, Moorman filed a motion to modify Drew's bond. Among his arguments was that Drew's a priest, has no criminal history, and has extensive family in the area, including his ailing mother, his siblings, and close family friends. Moorman also said Drew's case has been handled differently than others because of media coverage. In his motion, Moorman said Giz had set Drew's $5 million bond at a hearing in front of no less than six television reporters and cameras. Giz rejected that argument. "Please don't ever accuse this court of doing anything because cameras are involved," she said. Drew, age 57, has pleaded not guilty to 9 counts of rape. Giz also pointed out that in Moorman's motion, he mentioned that Drew had been investigated within the last year in both Montgomery and Butler counties. Moorman mentioned those investigations to emphasize that authorities found absolutely no criminal activity for which to charge him. But Giz said she hadn't been aware of allegations in other counties, which she said raised concern. The Hamilton County charges all involve accusations by a former altar boy who was 10 years old when he said the alleged sexual assaults began in 1988. Drew's accuser, now in his early 40s, told prosecutors it occurred after school hours in Drew's office at St. Jude in Bridgetown. At the time, Drew worked for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati as a music minister at St. Jude and as a music teacher at Elder High School. He was not a priest then, but he entered the seminary in 1999 and was ordained a priest in 2004. And now we'll switch over to the Western Hills Press. Our first story, gas tax. Money for I-75, none for Western Hills Viaduct. Hamilton County is getting $38 million next year to help with Interstate 75 construction. But on the list of projects first in line to be funded by the state's new gas tax, there's no money for the Western Hills Viaduct. The list, still a draft, is from the state's Transportation Advisory Review Council. There is a public comment period in October, with the final vote on the funding expected in November. Comments can be emailed to track@dot.state.oh.us or mailed to Ohio Department of Transportation care of Jim Gates, 1980 West Broad Street, Columbus, Ohio, 43223. What local projects made the list? Interstate 75 widening. The local district of the Ohio Department of Transportation is getting $38 million to continue construction on I-75. The project will add a fourth lane, north and south, near the Kemper Overpass, as well as auxiliary lanes from Sharon Road to Glendale-Milford Road and from Sharon Road to I-275. State Route 32. Claremont County is getting $38 million to address what ODOT has labeled as some of the most dangerous intersections in the state. The initial application asked for $61.4 million, with the total project expected to cost nearly $127 million. What local projects didn't make the list? Western Hills Viaduct. Cincinnati and Hamilton County joined forces to ask the state for $190 million to go toward the viaduct replacement. That was more than the total pot available statewide, but the viaduct replacement is projected to cost around $355 million. State Route 63 widening. The Warren County Transportation Improvement District asked for $15.7 million to widen a portion of State Route 63, which connects I-75 to I-71. The application called the route a critical east-west regional connector, adding that current traffic demands far exceed capacity. How does it work? The money for the projects comes from Ohio's new gas tax, which was raised 10.5 cents per gallon in July. Statewide, ODOT awarded nearly $398 million for 20 different projects. Now, the list just covers funding for fiscal year 2021, which kicks off in June. There will be another round of applications and a new funding list for fiscal year 2022. While more than 90 cents of every dollar we invest into roads and bridges goes to maintaining our existing system, we still have to address congestion and enhance capacity where it makes sense, said ODOT Director Jack Marchbanks in a news release announcing the projects. Just a few months ago, ODOT was struggling to fund maintaining our roads and bridges. Money for major new projects wasn't even a thought. However, thanks to an increase in the state's motor fuel tax, a user fee, we've been able to move forward with these much-needed projects. Our next story from the Western Hills Press. New CPD officers give Price Hill a fresh coat of paint. Dozens of fledgling Cincinnati police officers were caught in a cover-up Thursday in East Price Hill. Luckily, it only involved new paint. The 109th recruit class, fresh off their probationary period, joined Seton High School and University of Cincinnati students, along with Price Hill Will and Keep Cincinnati Beautiful, and some University of Cincinnati police for the project. Sporting Price Hill Proud shirts, the 42 officers painted and spruced up sidewalk planters along Warsaw Avenue as part of the Neighborhood Enhancement Program Beautification Day. The 109th recruit class graduated from the police academy in July. Our next story from the Western Hills Press. Bill would require Ohio schools to start after 8:30 a.m. An Ohio lawmaker from Cleveland wants to change the start times for all public schools. State Senator Sandra Williams is calling for classes at public schools to start no sooner than 8:30 a.m. She introduced Senate Bill 218 on Wednesday, October 16th. Part of the proposed law states it would prohibit public schools from beginning the school day earlier than 8:30 a.m. Some superintendents, like Eugene Blaylock of the North College Hill City School District, believe that could cause problems. "I can see where that can be problematic," he said. "In the district I previously worked, we had transportation, and we had to stagger the starts just to get students to school. When you talk about the number of buses you would have to put on the streets and routes, you'd have to make sure all students get to school at the same time." Blaylock said he also feels there could be a financial impact. "You're talking about a financial impact and a strain on the resources, especially if you look at some of the more rural areas or some of the larger districts, where they are going from one side of the district to the other side of the district," he said. About half of Cincinnati Public Schools start at 8:30 or after. The school board passed a resolution to bring the other schools in. State Senator Cecil Thomas said in a statewide public school start time is not a good idea. "That decision," he said, "should be left to the school boards." Without knowing the specifics of the bill, if it's strictly requiring schools to start no earlier than 8:30, that could be problematic. Our next story from the Western Hills Press. Cincinnati man quits job to educate kids in Guatemala. Cincinnati's Joe Barringer is never far from Guatemala. One of the colorful paintings in his Westwood office overlooking a hilly green canopy of trees is a painting of Lake Atitlan. The volcanic lake formed tens of millions of years ago is stunning. That lake is a reminder of the place where he has worked half of his life to help children born into a dire existence learn to read, go to school, and pour back into their own communities. Barringer is the co-founder of the Cooperative for Education, or CoEd, a nonprofit whose mission is to break the cycle of poverty in Guatemala through education. It was founded in 1997 with his brother, Jeff. For Joe Barringer, the journey started in the early 1990s when he and Jeff visited the Central American country, 6 hours as the crow flies from Cincinnati, for vacation. Their aunt and uncle had been involved in missionary work there since the 1960s. Jeff, who was working at P&G, left his career to teach in a local missionary school in the rural Highlands. He found there were no books at the school or anywhere in the country. Teachers used chalkboards for instruction. A country without a public education tradition needed everything, starting with textbooks, so that's where Jeff started. He devised a plan to provide donated textbooks to the schools. Schools agreed to rent the books to students at $1 per year per book. Then in 1997, Joe, who had been raising funds for the textbook project in Cincinnati while working at IBM, went all in. The brothers started co-ed in earnest, and the work escalated. The nonprofit got started on that principle of let's put books in every school in Guatemala in a way that's sustainable, Joe Berenger said. So now, fast forward 22 years, that's still our largest program. The schools that we put books into back then still have books today, the descendants of those same books on that self-financing program. Today, as back then, the indigenous Guatemalan population suffers from poverty, racism, and illiteracy. Researchers estimate that for every 100 children in Guatemala, fewer than 40 will continue on to seventh grade, and only 18 will complete high school. The average indigenous Guatemalan adult has only 5 years of education. Not only does co-ed help provide books, but it also helps provide computers using the same self-sustaining rental approach. Computers cost $2.50 per month to rent. Most important, institutionalized and evidence-based reading approach aimed at getting kids reading by the end of the second grade, which is leading to better long-term outcomes. 7 out of 10 second graders now pass the international benchmark for reading fluency. Failure rates have dropped by a third, according to COED. Its RISE Youth Development Program focuses more specifically on educating girls who often face discrimination in their own families. 4 out of 10 women cannot read in Guatemala, compared to 2 out of 10 men. We can change a kid's life completely for $1,000 in Guatemala, and when you're here, that's such a drop in the bucket, Berenger said. Here, in the United States, people are poor for a lot of complex reasons. There, a lot of people are poor because of a lack of resources. Over the past 2 decades, more than 208,000 children have benefited from co-ed programs, including more than 55,000 this year. That's sustainable and leads to positive things. Let's start with Guatemala's proximity to the United States, which benefits trade. U.S. goods and services trade with Guatemala totaled an estimated $13.7 billion in 2017, according to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. Think fuel, coffee, 40% of its agricultural output, fruits, and apparel. Clearly, a more educated populace offers long-term benefits. North America is blessed with a tax base that pays for public education and drives commerce. In developing countries, such as Guatemala, with a population about the size of Ohio, the same principles can apply. First, developing countries need economic infrastructure. That starts with educating its populace. What's more, an educated Guatemala squares with U.S. immigration policy. More than 60,000 people illegally immigrate to the United States from Central America this year. About a third of them are from Guatemala. President Trump has ramped up border protection, including plans for a southern border wall and tighter immigration restrictions. I'm a firm believer in the adage of teaching a man to fish. Co-ed is a heart-driven organization, to be sure, but its programming approach can be embraced by bleeding hearts and data-driven conservatives alike. Regardless, at the end of the day, I think we can all agree that educating a kid, whether she's in Guatemala or Gallipolis, is simply the right thing to do. For more information, go to https://co-ed.org/ coeduc.org/fact/. Continuing to read from the Western Hills Press, Married at Blank, Wedding, a Moment of Serendipity. A blank exhibit in Over the Rhine recently became the backdrop for a wedding. Cincinnati residents David Warwush and Caitlin Highland chose to tie the knot Friday night underneath a blank display near Findlay Market, said Stephen Hoffman, the justice of the peace who married them. It was just one of those moments of serendipity, said Liz Godfroy of Northside, who happened upon the wedding. Godfroy said everything was quiet around the Sewell Alley near Findlay Market. She said a crowd of people formed into a horseshoe shape inside the alley. Carthage resident Jessica Wolf, the artist who created the display of 3,000 paper leaves to simulate a forest canopy over the alley, didn't know about the wedding ahead of time. Godfroy knows Wolf. I thought she would love to know that happened. That's just a beautiful moment, Godfroy said. Hoffman, who has married more than 30,000 people across northern Kentucky and Cincinnati, said it was one of the more memorable weddings he's presided over in a while. Highland and Wolfrush chose the spot, he said. The couple didn't want to advertise the wedding ahead of time, but were pleased with the people who spontaneously watched the ceremony, Hoffman said. It was just a nice little magical moment, and it happened in time for Blink, he said. Hoffman said he was glad the artist liked the wedding. I didn't know what was going to happen at all, Wolf said. This was Wolf's first time displaying at Blink. Wolf has been making paper artwork, often for weddings, as favor boxes for 10 years under her Paper Acorn business name. The 20-foot-long and 12-foot-wide Blink display included images of frogs and insects glowing in some of the translucent paper leaves, she said. I really wanted to create like a little oasis in the middle of the city, Wolf said. Highland and Wolfrush decided Wolf's oasis in the city was worthy of their wedding. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. I'm Joe Bickers, wishing everyone a wonderful week.